Good morning, good afternoon, and to some of you watching from across the pond, good evening, and welcome to another episode of This is Revolution Podcast free show. This is our Saturday free show where we don't stop at the end of an hour and go into the patron-only champagne room. We just keep going and going and going. This is our funnest show of the week because we get to have our friends that live across the pond be a part of the live stream. So since we have such a packed show, let's start bringing in the hosts. First and foremost is my co-host, is my homie, he is my dog. He is the run to my DMC. He is the Pascal Robert.
Peace and greetings to the audience. Peace and greetings, Jason Miles. What's actually interesting about that is that Run was the headliner, and when I was in high school, people used to say that I looked like DMC.
Can you rap like him?
I cannot rap. He actually follows me on Twitter, as a matter of fact. But I've met DMC, believe it or not, in New York City, in Arby's in New York back in the day. I remember going to see DMC in the late 80s. I was telling him, I was like, yo, man, I'm looking forward to you guys putting out some new material. He was like, yeah, man, we're going to put
out. Well, you said that the album that changed your life musically was Raising Hell.
Raising Hell. Raising Hell. Raising Hell was an album that was a pivotal hip-hop album for my generation. That was the year I graduated high school. It was actually probably one of the most professionally produced hip-hop albums up until that point.
Let's bring in our other special host for the Saturdays. He told me before the most pivotal album for him that changed his life was Bone Thugs. Please welcome Marcus of the Left Flank Vets.
You know, that's actually a good guess. I was super scared. I was like, oh man, this motherfucker gonna set me up. I'll take Bone Thugs. I'll take Bone.
Bone, 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 bone.
Tell you what you gotta do.
Was that you like your
really,
high
really concept? Brought the finality of life, right? Life and death, right? You put it in the palm of your hands with those fake ass bird looking angel wings as you know, so Uncle Jerry floated off into the, you know.
They're still doing stuff. Or some of them.
Yeah, which, you know, Crazy Bone doesn't follow me, but I did buy him a drink at a bar in Columbus, Ohio. It was like one of the last few places where you could actually smoke inside. They had a little tip jar for the fines that they would pay.
None of my music heroes follow
you're
me.
You're from Columbus, Ohio, right?
Yeah. Mark? So actually, yeah. So two, Crazy is from like Westerville, but most of them are from Cleveland. But yeah, after the fame had died down, he just ended up back in Westerville.
Are you a major funk music fan?
I do. I mean, it's hard not to, you know. And like that's the thing too is like Ohio, especially Columbus, like there's just like a shit ton of concerts and everything like that, you know. Like so. Ohio Players, fucking Earth, Wind, and Fire come through there, and like I've seen them at like concerts at like high schools and shit.
Is Earth, Wind, and Fire from Ohio too?
No, but I mean like it's just because it's got, I mean like, oh, okay, I don't know.
Names I know Bootsy and them are from Cincinnati, and there's some more people from Cincinnati. Yeah,
Jason, listen, as much of a music connoisseur as you are, you know that Ohio is the birthplace of so many funk bands that it cannot even be. I mean, when I realized how much funk music comes out of Ohio, so I'm glad Dr. Claw is a fan of the show, I was like, man, every time I talk to folks from Ohio, I was like, y'all must be something in the water over there.
Well, know, it's funk and astronauts. So either people are just trying to, like, fucking, you know, here, completely check out or get the hell off of this whole planet.
Geez, Marcus is getting deep because now he's finding the point of confluence between Bootsy Collins and his albums and the actual astronautics that actually took off and went to NASA. That's why Bootsy had the rocket ship and that was part of the whole aesthetics. Marcus is breaking it down.
I'm gonna come up with a whole theory around Afro-pessimism and Ohio.
Afro-futurism.
It's just gonna meld.
We first got with Doug. He was and we used to put our shows on his channel. He was like, "I want an Afro-futuristic look." I was like, "I don't know what that means." Does that mean me and Pascal is in a spaceship?
Yes.
As long as Negroes ain't got to wear no diapers.
We're not done. The panel is so large today. Coming from across the pond, he wrote recently a really good article. It's in Sublation. I hope there's a link up in the description. If not, there will be a link in the chat to it. And I will put a link to the description of this article in the audio-only podcast. And this comes out Wednesday. Stefan Bertram Lee. You guys may not know this. Stefan is an old soul, and he said the album that changed his life was Kiss's Destroyer. Kiss Destroyer. And
do you know what I've got stuck in my head? I've got the 2 Chainz line, "She got a big booty, so I call it big booty," stuck in my head. But then I was flipping it around, so I was like muttering to myself in the kitchen, "She called me big booty because I got a big booty."
Stefan is built like Roger from American Dad.
Oh, shit.
And last but not least, she is the disembodied voice of reason. She is the M2 song. How are you?
Did you mute me?
Album that changed your life. I know you told me before off air it was In Vogue's first record.
What? Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
No.
Yeah, you told me that. You even did the harmony all on your own. You did like a 4-part harmony.
4-part harmony on your own. Ooh,
do it again.
No.
Never gonna get it. No, you're not gonna do it again.
Do it.
The best part. Right?
That was fine.
Y'all are good at this.
Jason's really bigging up like the mystique of what happened before the show.
Yes.
We talked about like lemon juice or whatever.
I was letting Stefan know that sometimes we have Axl Rose time when we come on here. You goddamn rock stars.
You'd be surprised how many people love the crap.
Good to see you, Stefan. Good to see you. I gotta say, I don't usually mess with people that have 3 names. They're a little scary. But I'm loving here today. There's no fan.
No one really calls Stefan by his whole name, right?
Is it spoilers to mention how we're thinking about getting Toussaint's face among us?
Hilarious.
I was wondering how that was going.
Well, you're going to have to use that avatar is what you're going to have to do.
Yeah, no, I didn't know if we were keeping that secret from the public.
Yeah, total secret.
Okay. No, that we're planning on making Toussaint a VTuber.
Yes. Yes, I'm excited for this. The Toussaint show is coming.
It's coming.
And anyone that guests on that show has to also be VTubed.
Okay. Okay, well noted. Stefan's foot is down.
I would love to also be there. The thing is, I think you need, if you do it not as a static image, but as a 3D image, I think you need like quite a serious graphics card to manage it. So maybe I wouldn't actually be able to do it, but I'd love to try.
Okay, wow. I appreciate it.
Yeah, this is great.
See the mutual affection here. I like his hair.
Jonathan Guerrero says Jason should get a luchador mask for Toussaint. No. That's cultural appropriation.
True.
But
speaking of cultural appropriation, someone in the chat has said that you look more Mexican every day.
Wow.
I think it's the tan.
Wow.
It's the mustache. It's the tan too. Just appropriating left and right.
What?
Give me that.
That's funny. Well, look, we have a very big show today because at some point today, hopefully, if we have time, I would like to talk to Stefan about his piece that he wrote about capitalism and fan fiction.
Can we talk about his hair more?
Can we talk about
that
his
was,
hair?
That was censored from Reddit fan fiction.
Also, you were censored from Reddit fan fiction?
Yeah, I mean, they recently imposed a rule which banned kind of discussion of monetization or commercialization, because apparently all the kind of conversations is in the absurd and useless. But really bad timing for me.
Oh, wow. But first, we are going to talk about something that actually people have asked us to talk about for a while now, actually, which is the Communist Party of India, Kerala, and something we really don't get too much to on this show, environmentalism. Would you like to bring in our guest, Stefan?
Yeah, we're going to be joined by my friend Nacho, who I know from the internet. So I recently met for the first time in person. After meeting them for the first time, they mentioned their kind of master's dissertation, which was on this topic, but they also mentioned that they hadn't been able to kind of publish anything on it yet. So I was like, at the time, I was like, ooh, maybe we could have him on our podcast, maybe get him in our magazine, but I didn't want to promise anything then. So I talked to Gene about it, and he was like, yeah, let's do it. And so, yeah, we're going to be joined by Nacho today for the kind of first time. He's kind of talking about this stuff in a non-academic environment, so hopefully it'll be good.
Well, I guess Nacho's having some issues with his camera, so he'll be another disembodied voice. Oh, there he is. Oh, I see him. See him in the green room. God knows what Nacho is doing. Please welcome Nacho! Now, that is not your name. Your name is Juan Ignacio Rubio, and then the last name is so long. I'm
it's
not
Basque.
Going to try to book
it. That's why it's very Basque. Long.
Ah, the Basque.
The aliens.
Probably the only people in Europe more arrogant than the French.
I do not want to butcher your name, Nacho.
Don't worry. And just to keep, like, to avoid the confusion, Stephanie's right. My real name is Juan Ignacio, but in Spain, everyone calls Ignacios Nachos, and it doesn't come from the Mexican dish or anything. It's just like the nickname for it. So it's a pretty common name in Spain.
Wait, so Spain, you can't order nachos because a bunch of guys call Juan a nacho and it's going to come and want to
I don't think
up.
They eat nachos in Spain. It's not a...
No, we don't have the tradition to. You can have them in Mexican restaurants, but it's not...
you probably have them in British restaurants. Yeah.
I did that. Don't do that. I did that in Bath. Don't do that. That was a huge mistake. Don't order nachos in the UK.
The good thing about eating British food while being British and having lived in Britain your whole life, you don't know what you're missing.
Well, we didn't bring Nacho in here to make fun of Stefan, but that sounds like a good plan.
Why not?
But Nacho, a lot of your writing revolves around the Communist Party of India. Can you tell us a little bit about the Communist Party of India? Because here in the States, I think it's harder for us to understand Indian politics because it is broken up by region. When we think of there's the Grand President Modi, what do you mean there's other people running these different regions? So if you could explain.
Yeah. So the Communist Party of India, it's just one of about a dozen different communist parties with active national presence. It's actually called the Communist Party of India, Marxist, between quotation marks, because to distinguish itself from the Communist Party of India, Marxist-Leninist, the Communist Party of India, full stop, and the Communist Party of India, liberation. Like, it is one of the eight national parties of India, which has means that they have they run campaigns and they have representation all over the country. But Kerala, it's currently it's only a stronghold left. They used to be very, very, very important, and the ruling party. In fact, they were the ruling party of West Bengal, where Kolkata is located. Mm-hmm. They also had some strong presence in other states like Tripura, but right now, they're only the only state in India where they still have strength is it's Kerala in just for those who don't know, Kerala is in the southern tip of India, facing the Arabian Peninsula. And it's one of the most diverse states in the country. It has, I think, around 20% of the population is Christian, which is a really high share for India. Around 20-30% is Muslim, and the rest is mainly Hindu. Kerala.
The main language communication is English, right?
Well, yeah, the native language is called Malayalam. It's a Dravidian language that is very similar to Tamil. But they use English as working language with the government of India. They are actually one of the reasons why it's actually not that hard to find the official documents that people like me who don't speak an Indic language and languages can understand and read this, because they are very keen on using English because they don't want to use Hindi, which is the main working language in India.
Yeah, so for all the grad students out there, for communist grad students out there, you can study Kerala communists, and you'll probably be able to read it all.
One of the things that I found fascinating about this particular phenomenon in Kerala with the Communist Party is that how, and Jason talked about this, the politics of India are always projected as the BJP, the ever-present kind of Hindu fascist, specter that's always governing everything. How is it possible that this Communist Party is able to even maintain some level of regional autonomy in the face of this constant kind of Hindu presence?
There are, I would say, two main reasons for that. First, there's a long tradition of Marxism in Kerala, going back to pre-independence times. Second, the BJP has had some issues trying to, to gain power in the southernmost states of India. They are still seen to some extent as a party of the Hindi belt in Uttar Pradesh, of Bihar, of Rajasthan. The secularism of Kerala and its great religious diversity, it also insulates the state from the effects of Hindutva. I don't know how long it will last. We've seen that other states that haven't been expected to fall to the BJP have very much done so in the past. But right now, the BJP is it has a marginal presence in the state politics. It's actually, the state is divided between two broad coalitions, each one led by the Communist Party of India, Marxist, and the other is led by the Indian National Congress, which at the Indian National Congress, or in short terms, Congress, is the party of Gandhi and Nehru. It used to be the main dominant party of India up till the 90s, well, even the late 2000s. And it's a lib party. It's secular, center-left, two centuries. It was in the 50s and 60s under Nehru and his daughter, whose surname was Indira Gandhi. It was part of the non-aligned movement, but it was seen as closer to the Soviets than to the Americans, because it very much enacted a social democratic consensus in India. They did a lot of pretty shady stuff in the 70s during the emergency, and they become quite dictatorial in their own right. And nowadays, after post 80s, they have very much moved towards the center. They have lost, though, the character, the dominant party mantle towards the BJP, who has been really successful in combining both Hindu nationalism and pretty right-wing economics.
What I found interesting, you mentioned kind of the left alliance in Kerala, and people in chat, when you kind of outlined all these communist parties, were like, splitters. But what I found interesting about, and maybe kind of got a too rosy view of it, you can say, But in Kerala, all these different communist parties are split from each other, but they also collaborate. They're kind of all in the governing alliance together. I think this is generally, outside of the Naxalites, true in India, that while the communist parties are split, that doesn't mean they don't collaborate with each other.
Yeah, they are currently grouped in what they call the Left Front, which is a wide coalition. It not only includes most communist party with presence in Kerala, it also has some secular liberals, it has some local independent parties, but you're completely right in that despite having a high level of division, which is also quite normal in most political parties in India, like Congress has split, I believe, in the past in about 15 different minor parties. So it's many times it's also not a matter of policy or ideological differences, but just some egos. Like it's normal in India to have parties that are named after the main founder, literally just the name of the of the founder, like, and they pretty much work as personal fiefdoms.
Oh wow.
Yeah, and obviously kind of with the size of the country, it's quite easy to fit all these different parties in, right?
Yeah. It's again in the south. It's also quite interesting because there's like due to the lack of a strong political force that being the BJP in the north, you have a lot of coalitions and different parties joining together to get majorities in the regional part in the state parliaments.
Marcus, you want to say something?
Yeah, no, I kind of asked you wondering if you could just kind of explain the power dynamics between the national government and these different regions. You know, what type of autonomy or what type of control and powers does Kerala and the left government kind of have over the region, and you know, like, how does that play out as far as like land, economics and all those things?
So Kerala, as I said before, under the Congress rule, India was seen as very chummy with the Soviet Union. So one of the first things Nehru did after independence was set him up five-year plans for the whole country, under the influence of the Stalinist five-year plans in the Soviet Union. That was something. 5-year plans serve as a way of coordinating economic development and economic and infrastructure projects all across the country, but the states, the different states in India, were also allowed to have their own 5-year plans for their in their own regions. Those 5-year plans were eventually dropped by the BJP government once they acquire power in the early 2010s, but Kerala remains as the only state in the entire country that still has them. I wouldn't be surprised if that becomes a point of contention in the future. It hasn't been the current BJP government has been pretty willing to scrap regional autonomy when it proved to be an obstacle to the national plans. I don't know if you remember, but a couple of years ago, they altogether scrapped the regional autonomy of Kashmir, of Jammu and Kashmir in northern India, which is the disputed region that they have with Pakistan, and that under the constitution that was adopted in India after independence had given its own special autonomy rights. Again, that was that article in the constitution was derogated, and if the BJP with its Hindutva impulses I wouldn't be surprised if they tried to centralize the country under that basis using Salami.
How easy is it for them to amend the constitution?
Sorry?
How easy is it for them to amend?
Well, they currently hold a super majority in the Lok Sabha, in the national parliament in New Delhi.
That's all you need.
And the Supreme Court, it has been rubber stamping most of their stuff.
Okay, so India is kind of constitutionally federal, but BJP has the power to change that formally the power to change.
Yeah, I mean, as far as I know, they haven't formally announced any plans to do so. But
they could.
Again, it's hard to plan any, it's really hard to forecast what's going to happen in 10, 20 years in the future. But at the national level, the BJP is not dropping in popularity at all, and they are becoming increasingly authoritarian.
Yeah.
Well, let's pivot to what your thesis was all about, which was about environmentalism and Marxism. You actually had mentioned here, which I thought was really interesting, talking about Bill McKibben Marxists. They care more about how your toaster is made and delivered to you than if you need another one. What is the issue with the environmental crisis in this region of India that prompted you to even want to write this piece?
Yes. So, as I said before, like the political situation of Kerala is quite different from the rest of India. And its socioeconomic structure is also quite different. It has, if not the highest, the second highest, I believe, human development index of all the states in India. It has some of the highest literacy rates. And it has, under the social democratic consensus that was adopted between the Communist Party of India, Marxist, and Congress, it has been one of the most industrialized, like most economically developed in a Marxist sense, states of India. It is also known as historically at walls on country due to the biodiversity and the beauty of its landscapes. In Kerala, just to give a geographic overview, is situated between the Arabian Sea and the Western Ghats, which is a cordillera that goes, that goes between the southern tip of India all the way to Gujarat, I believe, which is in the northwest. Kerala is thus considered to be a tropical paradise. It is one of the most tourist-heavy regions in the country. Mm-hmm. It has coconut plantations. It has rubber plantations. It's very fertile and very biodiverse as well. The issue that has occurred is that with all these developments, the pristine environment of the state has suffered from exploitation and from overconsumption.
And that's a problem. Sorry to interrupt you. Yeah. And that's kind of a problem throughout India, right?
Yes, definitely.
So has a big stronghold.
One of the worst environmental disasters in terms of human life lost of the last half a century is occurring in Bhopal in North India after the don't remember the exact details. It was in 1984, I believe. But there was like a gas leak from one industrial plant that killed thousands of people.
Oh my goodness.
And the BJP's record at the national level, it's absolutely dire. They have been increasing deforestation in order to increase mining and to increase cultivation. Mm-hmm. They have done very little to put India into the aims of the Paris Agreement, and they consider environmentalism as an obstacle to the industrial and development aims of India.
Did you have a question to follow up with, Stefan?
Not particularly. I mean, I was just being paranoid. People have been saying in the chat that my sound was bad, so I was just being paranoid about that.
Oh, don't see. You can't watch the chat, man. It's dangerous.
Well, no, if the fucking microphone's like coming out to YouTube, then I should pay attention.
Oh,
well,
don't
worry. I had a follow-up
question. We have a private chat where we'd yell at you if it was that much of a problem.
So not
I guess the problem is it's going to YouTube and having a problem there. And Gene said it was a problem, so they're probably not making it up.
So according to what you're saying, for the BJP, the ruling Hindu Rashtra Party, environmentalism is just an obstacle that they want to bypass. But at the same time, how exactly is the Communist Party, the CPI, dealing with the issue in this region where they seem to have more governing autonomy, since in the face of this history of rather prosperous stewardship on their part, they don't want to keep those numbers at a high level? How are they balancing that?
The BJP has had, if I'm being honest, and coming from a left-wing perspective, also pretty bad in terms of in their environmental record. Most figures in the and most governments, most communist governments in Kerala since the 50s, have deemed the environmentalist movement as an anti-science, anti-farmer, anti-development movement. They consider it as a massive obstacle against the development plans, and they have used Marxist rhetoric about obscurantist primitive forces stopping the development in well-being of the Keralan citizens. So, for example, there's a really fun example I found in my research. In one of the internal disputes that the CPIM had in the 90s about environmentalism, one of the leading figures in the party that was proposing a much greener course was accused of being a CIA agent that had been sent by the American government to stop the development of the proletariat of Kerala.
Well, I highlighted this part of what you wrote, and I wanted to definitely get Pascal to jump in on here. He said, the growing division between two wings of a mass leftist party reminds me of the ideological struggles between the old left and the new left that occurred in hegemonic social democratic parties in the West post-1968, and suggests that the environment versus development debate is very much a staple of Kerala's political scene.
Let me tell you something. Yes. When I was reading your dissertation, one of the things that I found most compelling was how you were very eloquently able to explain how environmentalism was a major short sight of the Marxist left because of the belief in the need to develop an industrial proletariat. And that many of the old guard Marxist left, many of them coming out of the MLs, many of them coming out of the post-Stalinist period, even the Soviet Union in its internationalist phase, was wedded to this kind of international industrial development of the proletarian masses as the foundation of socialism. Yet what you clearly make very, very obvious is that they really dropped the ball in calculating the importance, or not even dropped the ball, were unable to even address the ball when it came to the issue of environmentalism, and made it seem like this was just total quackery. And it's fascinating that there's little difference between the reactionary right on this issue and the Marxist-Leninists, and the Marxists in general, frankly.
Well, yeah, it is. It really is a pity on that respect, because it's not like there has been an environmental strike in Marxism going back to the very founder of the political current himself. Like Marx wrote about extractivism and about the
accumulation.
Yeah, and about primitive accumulation. So it is not something that I personally believe that it's that Marxism shouldn't be opposed to environmentalism. In fact, it goes too many peasants and agrarian workers in the third world. Environmentalism and Marxism go hand in hand. They are like you cannot have economic justice without also having economic justice. It is complicated because the examples we've had of Marxist regimes in the 20th century have been quite bad for the environment. There's, of course, I believe I use in my dissertation the example of the RLC in the Soviet Union, which was completely dried up to increase the cultivation of cotton in the Soviet Republic of Uzbekistan, which was part of the Soviet Union at the time. And I think we all know what's going on in the People's Republic of China. Like, even though the situation, I must say, has improved a lot in the last 10 years. There's definitely green movements and Marxist movements have been seen as being on opposing sides for a long part of history, and even nowadays you still have both Marxists who are not keen on taking any environmental perspectives. I'm talking about the First World now, but any environmental perspectives as long as economic justice has not achieved, and also green liberals who consider that capitalism is the best tool to achieve good and optimum transition, an optimum climate transition. So yeah, you it's not as clear thought by the past by some of these moments that this synthesis can be achieved, even though if in my opinion you have both past examples and you have fertile ground for that synthesis to occur.
Well, how is this battleground being played out in the Communist Party of India in this particular area in Kerala?
In Kerala, well, there's been some tribute being given to environmentalist causes in the current communist government, which has been ruling the state since 2016. The manifesto that they ran in the 2016 elections, let me just quote, I want to quote the exact phrasing they used because it was quite a strong rhetoric. They said that Kerala would be made the cleanest state of India and priority would be given to the disposal of waste and pollution. They use the phrasing, we will fight all measures that are both anti-environment and anti-people, which I think it's really interesting because it equalizes the idea that development that is anti-environment is also anti-people and prejudicial towards economic justice. However, they haven't put that into action. They have been rallying for 6 years at the point, and they have very much continued sweet treats to the tourist industry. They have increased private partnerships with massive tourism groups. They have continued with the monoculture of coconut, which is really bad for Keralan soils. Again, there's really not been much action given. There is, however, I would say, some ray of hope, which in one particular aspect, which is the matter of hydroelectric projects. Most of the Keralan rivers have been dammed in the past in order to obtain energy for the economic development of the state. But there have been papers, and there has been an official national government report that pointed to the damming of the rivers as one of the causes of the 2018 floods in the state that killed almost 500 people and caused damages in the range of millions of of rupees. They're one of the big projects that the CPIM had promised if they had won the election had been the Attirapili River Dam, which had been very much contested by environmentalists, both environmentalists and also grassroots indigenous groups. At the time I was writing my dissertation, the government had announced that it was going to start working on it as soon as possible. But however, due to pressure, funnily enough, from other communist parties within the broader left front and lobbying from environmentalist groups, the project has been dropped altogether. It was dropped last October, I believe, October 2021. So you can see that they are still facing pressure. They are getting more and more pressure to seek a greener avenue for economic development, and they are getting contestation from inside their political coalition, which is something that hadn't occurred before. So, for example, the Communist Party of India, with no other labels, which is the second largest party within the left front, now has found a newfound avenue in green issues to drive a wedge between itself and the Communist Party of India Marxist. It is now trying to seek green politics as an area where they can claim to be more responsible and more green-minded than the Communist Party of India Marxist. Sorry if interrupt me if you find the labels a bit confusing, because as I said before, there are like a dozen communist parties. They are fighting now on the issue, like on this and many other issues. So it's a bit it's a bit hard sometimes just to keep track of all the different political forces.
Are they also fighting over the issue of naming? Because that seems like it could be a little contentious as well.
Toussaint, you had a question you wanted to ask, right?
Well, I wanted to say I did enjoy reading your dissertation very much. I'm also very interested in the intersection between environmentalism and leftism. To Pascal's, I guess, earlier point, to me, it seems like it's an entirely different worldview going from Marxism to environmentalism. And I feel like I see a block. They do still see it as environmentalism as an impediment. But then that brings us back to this Bill McKibben quote about Marxists, communists, and capitalists care more about how your toaster is made and delivered to you than whether or not you need another one. So I'm trying to figure out, how do we bridge this gap? How do we break through leftists, putting the proletariat first in a way that is not good for the environment?
Have a lot to do with industrial development too, with the lands? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and I wanted to mention that I think this conflict is especially intense or interesting in the third world, because, for instance, in the UK, it's like, should we use coal? Well, it's very environmentally bad, but also it's not kind of the most effective resource we have in terms of, like, we have the facilities to produce electricity with kind of clean methods, which, while having an initial kind of much more expensive input cost, are more efficient than coal and so on. But obviously the problem in the third world is, in less developed countries, environmental kind of green power solutions are much more expensive to start, and so it can be rational economically in the short term to, you know, use coal, use gas and so on, while it might not even be still rationally kind of productive in the first world.
Yeah, I completely agree with Stefan on that regard. Like, I think you cannot ask the third world, which has barely industrialized, and in many places it hasn't even started, to sacrifice their economic development due to the mess that we have created in the imperial core, really. Because it's quite hard to determine, but it's pretty clear that the most polluting, the most polluting countries up till the turn of the 21st century, where the countries of Western Europe and the USA and, well, Canada and North America more widely. So it's hard. If I knew the answer to the question on how we actually thread the needle, I would be running for election. Like I would be trying, because it's gonna be the big question of the 21st century.
Can we consider climate a material condition? Would that help? Do you think that helps even just in thinking about it?
Oh, I very much agree. So, like, for example, on the in the Indian subcontinent, just with a moderate increase in sea levels, you're gonna see hundreds of millions of people who will have to flee their homes. Like, which the entire nation of Bangladesh will disappear. Basically, it really is as stark as that.
Venice too.
I don't know if Nacho, you can even want to comment on like the kind of the importance of, you know, not only India, but, you know, Southeastern Asia. There's the amount of people there and like also the amount of like extraction and imperialism causing the lack of development and like kind of, yes, the importance. And also, too, I mean, like recognizing like a moral and sensible future has, you know, immigration scales in the hundreds of millions. You know, if we're actually taking climate, the changing climate seriously. So I don't know if you have any, you can even expand on that more of like specifically within the Kerala region of like the amount of people and the amount of resources necessary to actually start changing. And I guess what would you like to see forward? And also the dynamic of this region in general.
Well, I think something that would help would be putting as, and again, I use this as a very general solution for most problems, is truly putting science into the hands of the people. We have the means to drive an ecological transition that is fair for everyone, I would say. We just lack the impulse, and again, we are operating under a neoliberal framework that seeks profit at its short-term profit, as its main aim. Until we change that mindset, and until we put technology, until we put that science into the hands of the people, we won't be able to do anything else. We will continue as now, which we shouldn't be allowed to, because it's gonna be catastrophic if we do.
Do you think we're near to kind of a tipping point where kind of green energy will become a lot cheaper than kind of non-green energy, and also kind of the input costs are starting to become significantly less? Because, for instance, like in Syria, due to kind of sanctions, one thing, and kind of massively inconsistent electrical supply, as well as kind of intermittent bombing and kind of cyber attacks from Israel, one thing that people have started to do in Syria is buy solar generators. Obviously, it's a very sunny country. Like personal solar generators and putting them in the house to kind of gain consistent electricity. But obviously this is still very limited by sanctions and blockade, but it's probably more viable in other places.
Yeah, I don't really know the situation, how it is in Syria, but I wouldn't be surprised if that is something that happens also in other countries being affected by sanctions at the moment. I mean, currently it's a matter of lack of will, as you're saying, or of geopolitical obstacles rather than scientific ones. I don't want to be, because there are some dangers of it, a techno-optimist either. We cannot just rely on, we won't be saved from the worst effects of climate change just by, you know, like giving Elon Musk $500 billion for him to block the sun.
What if the Communist Party of India, Marx's $500 billion?
That is a different aspect. That's the thing. You have to, like, the green transformation has to go hand in hand with a change in the mindset of people. Like, and I'm not asking you to eat the bugs or to live in the pod, but I'm asking you to eat less meat, to drive less, or to stop driving altogether, and to be conscious. I am very there is this famous comic from the, like, that is being posted on Twitter every time about, like, oh, and yet you live in a society and you consume, which I feel is very much a cop-out these days. Like, the point is still has some truth to it, but it's not a what's the word in English? Sorry. It's not a get-out-of-jail card. Like, it's...
Yeah, that's obviously kind of like, we shouldn't act and be ridiculous. We shouldn't, like... You know, before in my life, I've, like, flown from Athens to London to, like, go to the bank. And that's not the sort of thing people should do. You shouldn't do that. But also, I think what we need to bear in mind when we say these things is to make a distinction between kind of the left, who are concerned with these things contingently, and kind of conservative environmentalists who might view themselves as very left-wing, but in the end are conservatives in the sense of wanting to slow down or defeat economic progress, who are personally like ascetics, they want people to own less things, and so on. That kind of, when we say, you know, you should drive less, this only applies up until the point where we have a green power network. And once we have a green power network, you can drive from John O'Groats to Cornwall every day as much as you want. It doesn't make a fucking difference. So I think, yeah, we can say these things, but we should bear in mind that we can say, I mean, it's a positive. Like, we can say, like, slow down your driving for now, and then in 10 years, you can drive as much as you fucking want, you know?
Well, also, I mean, cities are designed for us to drive, right? Especially in
American
states.
City. Yeah.
American cities, to more extent. Like, I would say, for example, in London, I live in London. I've been living there for 7 years. I don't even have a car license because I don't need to.
Right.
And driving drive crazy.
Well, that's, yeah. I mean, that's like people like New York. Like, people, like, a lot of people who grow up in New York City, you know,
don't have driver's licenses. I don't have one.
Gallant Toussaint.
I learned to drive in New York at an early age only because I lived in the suburb. I lived in Queens. But I've known people in New York City who didn't have driver's licenses until their 20s, until their 30s. And it's very common. But, you know, this, I want to get on this point because it really brings it home how much the internal infrastructural design of our society in the United States is really designed to just keep profit going to the auto manufacturing companies, oil industry, energy sector, to the detriment of society, to the point where even our major cities were structured in a way to discourage quality public transportation, quality walkways, and quality means of actually commuting citizens in a way that did not depend on major vehicles and automotives. And I think of places that we have all over the country, like Florida, where we do not have quality public transportation, where everyone has a car, where we have massive traffic problems. I think of cities like Atlanta now, where you have, to the point where the infrastructure is so bad that people are literally driving over roads that have been there since the time Dr. King was alive, and no one is talking about what things can be done to fix them. I'm thinking about places like in California, where we have not had any kind of public housing developed for quality for the unhoused and the homeless situation. And it's like, we can't get, and at the same time, when we have all of these crises in America, all of them, by the way, interface with the environmental problem. We're going to have people who will tell us that government has no role in providing services to the American people.
Well, we can get into that later on the show if you guys are down, because there's a bill that's coming up in the 2024 election in California that I think is interesting, and I did want to bring it up a little later. But these infrastructure problems that you're talking about, I mean, even when you think about the way we consume things and our the necessity for things like Walmart, as you destroy Main Street, you know, Walmarts are designed to be on the outskirts of a city so you can have space for a very large parking lot and a large shipping receiving area. That's literally part of the design. So it's impossible to have them in a city that's walkable. So when you look at places like New York, where Marcus and I just were not too long ago, first of all, they're going to push back against a Walmart.
Yes.
Hard. And second of all, you just really can't have one there.
Well, I'll
there's
say
a, there's a Target in D.C. that's in a basement.
New York City is also a union town, so there was strong pushback on Walmart coming in. Also, oh my gosh, I lost my point. yeah, all right, go ahead.
Well, I did want to mention, though.
Coming from an European perspective, and again, carries use a lot, but when I see how American cities are laid out, I despair. Like, I remember I went to LA and I, 2014, and I found it one of the most depressing places I've ever been, just in terms of, like, it was all sunny. I went in the summer, like, classic summer Californian vibes, and still I could only think, Jesus Christ, why is everyone driving everywhere? Like,
well, that's the layout of the city. This is something, though, that, you know, Pascal, shame on you for missing this, because there are parts of Florida that have some of the best public transport in the whole country.
Bullshit. In Orlando?
We call that Disney World, yes.
I was going to say. Florida, dude, the whole state, dude, walking in Florida.
Not the whole state. I mean, but that's the thing. It's like, you go to Disney
World. Isn't that how that football player got killed?
And you see.
Isn't how the football player got killed trying to walk across the freeway?
I mean, I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, he was an Ohio State guy.
Well, I'll say one of the solutions environmentalists give to the issue of cars and all this is to have sidewalks. There are places in the United States that don't even have sidewalks. You can get more people on bikes. You can even get the kids to go. And it's healthier. All of those things.
There is one book I don't remember the title, but about Robert Moses.
Robert Moses.
Yeah, and how he, well, I mean, again, if you start into the racial and class and class-based components of about city planning, there has been a ton of books written about it, and it's very interesting how it works as well, especially in the U.S. context. Like, it's a cliche to say that we need intersectionality, but honestly, a walkable city would help on so many other issues as well. Like, you would have it a much less segregated city. You would have a city that's much more welcoming to the poor and to the homeless. Like, it's a no-brainer to me. But again,
well, that last thing you said, that's the problem, you know, being more welcoming to poor and homeless. Like, that's exactly why the suburbs are made the way they are. So it's like, it's not easy to not have a car. It's not easy to not, you can't survive out there. The buses aren't going to come by. You're not going to be able to get anything.
Yeah, I read this Color of Law book recently, which is about kind of U.S. housing segregation, and specifically kind of the direct involvement of state and federal government in doing so. And yeah, I learned that loads of kind of light rail projects, like for instance in Baltimore, which would have expanded light rail out to kind of the suburbs and surrounding towns and cities, were just vetoed by the local residents because they would make it easy for poor people, well, and specifically poor black people, to come to their suburbs.
Yeah, I mean, like, I'm at the end of like, one of the metro lines. I'm like,
I mean,
yeah.
There's some issues with Rothstein's book, and I don't know if you picked up on a lot of those issues with Rothstein's book.
I found the framing very annoying. Like,
He's very libertarian. So you have to.
All right, it didn't seem libertarian to me. Just completely lib, you know, like.
No.
You know, in the sense, like, it was all kind of orientated as an argument against kind of the Supreme Court.
Because he's a libertarian.
Yeah. It's funny because I did pick up, and of all the books I've read, he was the only one that didn't pay any lip service to kind of socialism or anything like this.
No, because he is not. And that's the first thing he'll tell you. Because I interviewed him a long time ago, which I was kind of excited about. I won't get into personal shit, but...
just to make a very off-topic comment about something. Another thing that really weirds me out about the U.S. is in Spain, libertarians are on the left. That was the label the anarchists during the Civil War used for themselves.
Yeah.
Like the libertarian movement. So when I first found out about the libertarians in the U.S., and I thought, oh, that's really cool. Finally, they're like...
Then you started watching Joe Rogan's podcast, and you're like, oh, this is different.
If you want to know which kind of libertarian you're dealing with, just ask about the age of consent. They will reveal themselves.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's why are there so many nonsense in the Libertarian Party? Like...
I mean, what's you call him? The Sandy Hook guy? The conspiracy guy?
Alex Jones.
You guys all know that Alex Jones is like one of the main funders of the Zapatistas.
No way.
Are you making this up?
No, because, I mean, I obviously don't know how much he sells, but as well as selling, like, weird pills and stuff and exercise stuff, the other main thing he sells on his website is coffee, which is from the...
I heard about that. That's what I've heard before. Wow. Fucking... So,
this is definitely a non sequitur, and now poor Nacho is with us as the show has gone a totally different off the rails.
Nacho brought up libertarians.
So if Alex Jones is supporting the Chiapas region with his coffee, is this a problem then? And should we support Alex Jones?
White people are stealing from the Zapatistas by making this legal whatever about their kids getting shot or whatever, and they're stealing $60 million. They're gonna make the main seller of Zapatista coffee, the main funder of Zapatistas in the USA bankrupt, and that just shows kind of the imperialist America politics of American liberals.
Listening to Stefan say America KKKKA policies.
We need a sound drop.
America KKKA.
Which one, Toussaint? Your favorite one?
Okay. I don't know. Okay. Saying America KKKKA. I'd like to hear that. We do have two super chats. The first one. This one is from MIDI Doctors. He says, when it comes to environmental issues and energy consumption, you have a mandate, or Jevons' law will bury personal behavior gains via extra consumption, which sounds about right. I mean, we can cut back on driving, but Kylie Jenner took her jet from California to California, 35 minutes. So.
Well, I mean, where did she go? I don't even know where you could go in 35 minutes on a jet, to be honest.
She went from Van Nuys to her mansion in Hidden Hills.
Where's Hidden Hills?
Palm Springs to Van Nuys. There we go.
It's hidden. Your broke ass wouldn't know where it's at.
I know where Palm Springs Airport is, like the size of my apartment. It's super small, and that is one of the bumpiest flights you will ever make.
So maybe that's why she did it. She was justified in everything.
Yeah. Props. I have bad news for people. That flight is more common than you think. And it ain't Kylie Jenner that's making it. It's regular ass people that's making it.
I have another super chat here. Where have Indian communist parties stood on seed and pesticide politics?
That's a good question. I know that in Kerala there were some controversy about endosulfates, which was a pesticide that was used up till the 80s and that caused a lot of environmental and personal damage until it was banned by the Supreme Court of India. As far as I know, the Communist Party of India Marxists led the campaigns to get compensation for the farmers that have been affected by the by the substance, but I am not entirely sure if they had supported it until its bad effects were discovered.
Did they have a stance on the pesticides and the farmers committing suicide with the pesticides?
Sorry?
Did they have a stance on the farmers committing suicide with the pesticide?
I am not entirely sure. I know that they put in their political manifesto several actions and several points to support to provide compensation for farmers that have been affected by it. But I am not sure to what extent.
How are they affected by Monsanto when it comes to these seeds and biodiversity?
For legal reasons, I want to say Monsanto does not exist anymore.
Bayer.
Right,
what is it called now?
Bayer.
Bayer. The stuff that doesn't exist, so we should keep calling it the and then go and say all the conspiracies.
Yeah.
So one of the things Monsanto was doing in India was selling these copywritten seeds that go with a certain pesticide. So you have to buy into their whole program. Farmers were ending up in debt if anything went wrong with their crops, and so they were in debt, and a lot of them just committed suicide by drinking pesticide.
VJ Prashad was talking about this on Brianna Drug Ray.
Happens in the United States too.
There's apparently another super chat by Strom, and I remember because I read the comment, but I can't remember what he said. But what I was thinking about when I read his super chat is that the super chats just kind of appear in the kind of the Restream Studio thing. It's just kind of the text where it says like super chat, $2, and then like a hyphen. And I was like, you could just type that out before your message and like say super chat, $10,000.
Well, I can see it though in the regular chat. Strom McCallum said, walkable small town and city revival to PL0X. Do you know what that means? Blocks?
Blocks.
Yeah.
Block.
Please, young person, tell us what that means.
Blocks? Blocks is definitely an old, that's when kind of people, you know, would write in kind of slightly wrong English. You can't really do anymore because Google spell check will kind of force you to write properly.
True.
Yeah, like Autumn Leaves just gave us $10 million.
Blocks means please.
It's because you put that seed out there, Stefan. Thank you so much for destroying the integrity of our chat.
I do have another question about the region in general. Wanted to talk about fast fashion really briefly. So the fashion industry is the number two polluter worldwide, second only to oil and gas. There's a lot of manufacturing of clothes, and also a lot of the fibers are grown in the region. A lot of cotton comes from India, a very thirsty crop, needs a lot of water. So I just want to know just sort of an idea of where these parties stand on fast fashion, all the pollution that takes place in order to create clothes, dyes, everything.
Thank you for giving me another reason to hate the fashion industry.
Yet you wear clothes.
True. Yeah, paraphrasing notable POC hero Elizabeth Warren, every shine purchase is a policy failure.
Did you say person of color?
Noted person of color.
Nacho's got the jokes, man.
Well, Nacho, thank you for joining us.
Please, it was a pleasure.
We appreciate it. And is this piece, well, this is your dissertation, but are you publishing something in Sublation soon or publishing something somewhere?
I haven't planned on it, but I would be more than glad to discuss with Stefan maybe something.
Oh, I thought I already told you. You're right.
Because I'll be honest, I have pitched to Tribune before. I don't know if you've heard of the magazine. It's
Tribune, you said?
Yeah.
English Jacobin.
Trivium, it's called?
Tribune.
Oh, Tribune. Oh, let's say Trivium, like the shitty band? You mean Tribune, okay.
Tribune, mate.
Tribune, mate.
Yeah, mate. Want to listen to some ska, mate? That do you?
Oh God! What if Stefan loves ska and like the moment that the call hangs up, he puts on his ska hat and he's just got checkered pants underneath? That would be awesome.
The checkered pants belong to Pascal.
Jabot, you didn't know Pascal was in the specials?
Doesn't
no one knows ska Jamaican jokes.
Doesn't
you guys
ska
all
have Jamaican music origins?
Sure. Yeah. It's British as shit.
Yeah. I've heard that though. That there's some correlation.
Yes.
Yeah.
Ska music.
Yeah. Ska. You remember that song Our House in the Middle of remember that song? Yeah, that's the ska band Madness.
But there's also some bad racial politics involved with ska as well though.
There can be. That's more oi.
Oi, bro.
Is an offshoot.
Yeah,
of
we're getting into a whole.
Let me tell you something. People always talk about how Jason and I we see us so much alike in terms of our politics, but we're so different. You don't understand how much I enjoy the intellectual Rolodex that is Jason's mind when it comes to popular music and popular culture. I mean, I have some interest in popular culture, but Jason is just. It's a joy to chat with him on these things.
Jason's like a cryptology museum, but for music.
Yeah, your memory's outrageous.
Yeah.
Jason, wait till you read my defense of nu metal.
I'm actually interested.
Every word I typed hurt my soul. But Nacho, thank you so much. And
thank you for inviting me.
Hey, no problem. But when we make it out to the UK, in London where you live, I'll make sure to smuggle in some spices from Mexico, and we can have Mexican food and Spanish tapas, and we won't let Stefan eat any. Because it'll all be too spicy, even though it won't even be spicy.
Ooh, spicy.
Thank you, Nacho.
No worries.
Thank you, Nacho. So, Stefan, before we go, I do want to talk real quick about your piece, because I did think that was cool. The fan fiction piece was really cool. And I actually, the more we talk about your doctoral work, it's really interesting, because you almost are like those people that like flog themselves in the Philippines that one time of the year. Because you're reading about Afro-pessimism, you read Color of Law, which, by the way, I read a lot of it had to do with where I'm from. So if you read it, then you read a lot about the politics of my hometown, Richmond, California. You read Robin DiAngelo, I believe. You had to read both.
Why are you torturing yourself so much?
Because he wants to fat back and biscuits in academia.
The thing is, I kept like I was looking at the books and I was like, I'm gonna leave that one for later because it's gonna be really, really bad. And then I'd get to that one and I'd be like, it's not so bad. Like the Robin DiAngelo one was the worst, and kind of very myopic. I mean, I've spoken about this before, but it's crazy how she just doesn't understand her kind of position as someone who is kind of imposed upon workers in a business, and never orientates people's negative reaction to her via the fact that she's imposed on them by their bosses in kind of compulsory work means. But I mean, there is definitely kind of like a germ of truth in what she's saying about this whole white fragility thing, because she's completely right. I mean, it's not just white people, but if there's something that gets like people in the West, especially in the English speaking world, like so incredibly pressed, like they're so fucking mad, it's being called racist. Like people have just absolute, like they just can't cope with it. It makes them go absolutely fucking crazy if you call someone racist.
Yeah, which is like, is a weird thing that we're kind of seeing, I think, with like the military recruiting in the US is like down, like terribly. Like army's fucking freaking out. And I think there's a lot of reasons, a lot of different reasons for that. But partially is because, like, there's a lot of right-wingers that are talking about, like, the woke military. You know, like, that message is, like, getting spread down. And, you know, because, like, the thing is, like, I think it's, like, fucking hilarious. You know, like, I mean, I was in a unit with, a fucking Nazi. Like, the dude had Mein Kampf, like, on his bookshelf. You know, he got out of the Marine Corps, no problem.
He didn't read it.
I don't care.
He didn't read it like nobody read. What's that guy that wrote that book about the U.S. fucking with communists?
I mean, read it or not. I mean, he's in a motorcycle club, you know, somewhere in the South.
So, he's definitely not reading it. Those guys come here like every other weekend. They're not at the bookstore.
Y'all
want to go to that coffee shop where they got all them books you can read for free?
Either way. So the thing is, though, is like there's a lot of right wingers that talk about how, like, because of the critical race theory, the diversity and inclusion and all this type of shit, it's like ruining the military. And obviously that's like a fucking joke. Like there's no real good, bad, and different, you know, when you talk about some of these programs, because they don't actually affect anything, you know, like whether it comes to like people being racist or sexist or any of this shit. But at the end of the day, you know, like to your point, that little bit of you're not allowed to be racist, you can't say the N-word, drives people fucking crazy. So it's kind of like the self-fulfilling prophecy.
I've never understood why people get so mad about wanting to say the N-word. Like, just say it, dude. Say it.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Which is kind of a strange thing. It's like the military isn't woke, but it is also still woke for them.
Because they disagree.
I think it probably limits kind of people's ability to actually kind of deal with racism, like kind of anti-racist people, this kind of complete kind of reaction and prohibition on being explicitly racist or at least being explicitly marked out as racist. Because it feels like if you call someone racist, like if you're a liberal, you call someone racist and they were like, yeah, I am. The liberal would be like, fuck, like, I don't know what to say now.
Yeah.
I can't be racist.
I think the social consequence of racism should be so absolutely great that it should deny you the capacity to function in society. And that's basically what they want, is that, you know, your capacity to function in society should be neutralized for being racist. I'm more interested in your capacity to cause harm being neutralized. Yeah. In society,
like when you're in law enforcement,
exactly, or in government, or in the state, or anywhere else.
Yeah, like the real racists are judges.
You said they're judges?
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, there's a guest we have on this show that I know personally that was telling me some stories about where they work at the court that are extremely frightening.
So of course, as I was learning in this other one, the new Jim Crow or whatever, the U.S. has so many mandatory minimums, often judges don't really have any actual power.
Yeah, that's also one of those books that is a hard read because the correlation
punishing the amendment
and the slavery is like not necessarily.
Yeah, true. Like I just didn't like it. Didn't really work to me. Kind of, I just kind of take these books as they are and kind of try and derive the best I can out of them I don't believe. Like I wasn't convinced, you know.
A lot of these books that you're naming too were like, going to like political science courses. Like they were, you know.
Hey, all of present them. Tense.
The reason I read these books is just
I
am reading like Baby's Beginner's Anti-Racism List, but just because those are the ones that sold the most copies.
But I do want to talk about fan fiction, which is, you know, the new Jim Crow. Just kidding. Pascal did not laugh at all. Pascal was like, yeah, and?
Correct.
I think of, Star Wars when I think of fan fiction. So when I saw that you had wrote this piece, I was like all excited, and then you didn't talk about Star Wars, and I was hurt. You talked about Harry Potter, and I was like, he's so young and he's so British. If I had a Kylie Jenner plane, I would slide into the UK, shake the shit out of him. But talk to us about fan fiction, the history of copyrights, which I found fascinating, and capitalism, and how all these things work together.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of started the story making explicit that kind of the system that we have now, where to kind of publish something and to make money off it, you have to kind of invent a new cast of characters. You have to set them in their own special world or use the actual real world, which for whatever reason is kind of copyright free. And then only then will you be able to produce a story. And if you use someone else's characters or you use their world, or even if you're found to be make a text which is significantly similar to those, you'll be kind of sued into oblivion. This situation for how literature works, for how stories works, is very, very new. Like, Homer didn't invent the character Achilles. He took it from his countries, his cultures, folk tradition. And this is basically how everything worked for thousands and thousands of years of human history. Human kind of storytelling was based on retelling. Like, and also remember, kind of, people didn't have that many books. Books were something that were very, very expensive. And this, to be, chat's really going to enjoy me saying the word books over and over and over again.
I'm enjoying it.
That's what you were saying. Yeah,
there were very, very few books that people could buy back then. They were very, very expensive. They're very, very hard to produce because each one had to be manually copied by hand. And so stories would be passed around by people that were kind of professional storytellers, or when these storytellers told stories to people within a village or whatever, people would learn these stories and then they would repeat them. But obviously what happens in this kind of in oral transmission is that the stories change because you can't perfectly remember them. And even if people could perfectly remember them, they like to change them around a bit. And so stories evolved and changed, and no one had to, occasionally it would happen that someone would produce a new story that wasn't really based on everything else. But the normal production of producing stories was kind of the slow, gradual transition of one story to another based on others. Like kind of the myth of King Arthur was not that something that one person came up with at some point. You can't find the original King Arthur book, but rather through kind of centuries and centuries of retelling the story, these kind of stories evolved out of earlier myths and legends and so on. But there was a big change in kind of from the invention of the printing press, things started to evolve, books became much cheaper. But then in the 19th century, there was an immense cheapening of books. And as well as kind of the literacy, which had been produced by the revolutions with the printing press and the conversion of the Bible into local vernacular European languages, there was both kind of the market for books and the ability to produce books. And to be clear, Jason, this kind of story I told of how copyright came out of this situation was like, it wasn't like the actual history. It was like a just so story of kind of, this is the sort of thing which happened. But the sort of thing that happened was that when the books become really cheap to produce, the thing that becomes valued is owning the story.
Mm-hmm.
When books are expensive, the thing that you care about is owning the book. The fact that someone else can copy it doesn't really matter because it's so much labor to put in. If you have the methods to kind of be a profitable bookseller is to have good scribes that can copy well, copy without errors, without fucking up and destroying paper and so on. But with the cheapening of books in the 19th century, it became trivial to produce the book itself. So the thing that you needed to possess in order to make a profit, in order to force out others, was the ownership of the story. And this just couldn't be a relationship between the book producer and the capitalist. It had to be a relationship between the book producer, the capitalist, and the state enforcement. Because obviously you can buy a story off someone, produce it, And then they, these books are out there, and anyone else can just copy it, and they'll be able to copy it and produce it cheaper because they haven't had to pay the author. And so the state intervened to produce these copyright laws, which would hold this situation in place. It would enforce this relationship between legally between the author and the book producer.
And then you go on to talk about how you can still like change one part of a story so that the laws have to keep kind of changing as people are.
Yeah, and it's not just kind of the, not just owning the manuscript itself, but owning characters and owning the world. Like, isn't it kind of just a bit bizarre that it's not that just J.K. Rowling or Disney, it's not that Disney just owned the Star Wars movies that they've made, which is, yeah, okay, that kind of, that basically makes sense. But they own like the concepts, these fictional characters which don't exist. It seems bizarre, but that's kind of the structure of capitalism, which has had to be imposed. And I think it's interesting, especially to use books in this context, as well as to talk about music, which I mentioned towards the end,
yes,
is that when products and capitalism reach a certain point in production, the kind of strategies of commercialization have to become more and more bizarre. And it's interesting, I think, to talk about fan fiction in these circumstances, because there was another transformation in literature, the transformation of literature, which happened when the internet became a thing. Mm-hmm. Now you can remove the book, the physical book, entirely from the equation. And hopefully I'll be able to stop saying the word now.
Well, when you talked about the whole chapter thing, I remember when Matt Taibbi released his last book. I believe he released his last book on Substack. And Substack became a big thing for journalists like Taibbi and even Greenwald, guys that were no longer getting published in the bigger liberal publications that were publishing them. And then they just figured, well, I can just monetize this myself. And instead of giving you the book, I can give it to you in chapters and you pay me a service fee. And it goes back to this rent, this economy of rents that we live in that we're now even seeing with the purchase of cars, right, where your heated seats are remote and they can be turned off for higher end vehicles. But the idea of ownership is definitely changing, and we are very comfortable in this world of renting content.
One of the deepest things I heard come out of Jason's mouth was, we don't own music anymore, we rent it.
Yeah. Yeah. When was the last? Let me ask you guys all a question, a serious question. And I don't even think age has anything to do with this. And I asked this question to the chat. Please respond. And when you listen to this later, respond in the comments, because I really want to know. Starting with Stefan, what was the last piece of music that you bought?
I can't remember, but it's probably like 2008, 2009.
Marcus.
Yeah.
Physical music that you can own, not digital stuff that you pulled off the cloud.
Physical music.
Music.
Yeah. I mean, what if I bought something off of iTunes and burned it onto a CD? Does that count, or do I have to actual purchase?
I guess.
That's weird. But did you do that? It would have been around the same time. I guess physical music, 2005, maybe 2004.
Pascal?
The last album I purchased on iTunes was the Roots album, Dear God?
Even movies. What was the last movie you guys, like physical DVD or VHS or whatever?
Oh, I haven't bought a DVD in ages.
There's not a disc in this room.
That's disc free. I
bought a bunch of DVDs off of a corpsman as he was coming off of deployment and I was going on. But most of those were bootlegs anyway that he had got.
Yeah.
Come around.
Earlier, we didn't have the internet, so we had to have innovative solutions. But it was just people carrying around hard drives with massive amounts of like torrented stuff on them. We weren't using CDs.
It's funny. I bring this up because I don't think we understand, because we're so connected with the internet. And usually when people travel, they're going to travel somewhere where there's internet access. My friend Josh Con Russell has been doing this shit in Peru, and he recently was on the Majority Report for Michael Brooks's memorial, and he had to drive like hours, like get rides to get to a hotel to use the internet because he had to go somewhere so remote to be disconnected from the internet. You know, moving here when I first got here, not having certain services, water, power, the internet, you go, what am I going to do for entertainment? We're just so used to this and we're so okay with the idea of not even owning anything. And then Stefan got you going kind of deeper into the this idea of fan fiction and Spotify. I don't think people realize how much music is released on these Spotify, Bandcamp, iTunes type platforms an hour. There's no way in the world anyone's going to know who you are unless you're massively touring or unless you have a budget behind you where you get on playlists that are the equivalent of pay for play.
Yeah,
which is technically illegal, but it's still a thing that happened.
We should have had Napoleon on. An interesting fraud strategy on Spotify, where people will upload kind of a song, mm-hmm. With on like a dodgy kind of like Russian kind of producer, like out like a label, which will let you upload anything if you kind of send them a request. And what mm-hmm. they do is they take the audio from like a viral YouTube video, like. Mm-hmm. And then they'll make a song, which will have like they'll put a formal date on it, which is before the YouTube video was published. Mm-hmm. And then they'll copyright strike the YouTube video via the Spotify music, and seize all the earnings from the viral YouTube video.
Fuck. Goddamn.
But I think fan fiction. Mm-hmm. is important to talk about in this circumstance, because obviously we can be all very negative about all these things, mm-hmm. but I think it's just kind of brilliant that we live in an era where millions and millions and millions of people produce millions and millions of stories online that you can read completely freely mm-hmm. in whatever manner you want. On, for instance, on Archive of Our Own, these millions of stories are then archived by a non-commercial company, which is in of itself kind of like it's like a charity or like an advocacy group for these kinds of creative fan works. And so, yeah, we can be kind of really negative about this, but I think it's also kind of very positive in the sense that we're kind of reaching a limit in how capitalism can commercialize literature, where kind of if the capitalists kind of maintain the strict copyright system, it's not necessary always to the benefit of them, because you then have people who just prefer to read fan fiction over normal fiction. And one of the reasons that people might prefer this is because of how easy it is to access. It's trivial to access fan fiction, and these websites have these very like kind of complicated sorting systems and tagging systems, which is allows people to find exactly what they want. And obviously most of it's crap, but you know, if you go on Amazon eBooks, there's also now an immense amount of bullshit. But obviously just because capitalism at the moment can't cope with this kind of thing, can't commercialize it, this doesn't mean this situation will last forever. And yeah, I think they may at some point try and adopt kind of like a Spotify model or of these kind of, or the model of, for instance, like these serialized fiction
yeah, you were talking
websites, like Radish, where basically, you know, it's going back to kind of how fiction was serialized in the 19th century. And you were mentioning that there's something similar on Substack, where kind of you publish your work, not all together, but chapter by chapter, which is also how fan fiction works. And there's various kind of models for this. Either you can choose that people have to pay for each chapter, or that they have to either pay or wait, like say a week after you publish a chapter before it becomes free to read, or the systems where you get to read the first chapter, but then that sets off like a personal timer for you of like say 8 hours before you can read the next one, or you'll have to pay. And the payment for each chapter is a small amount. say like 30 cents. But obviously this can build up. But obviously, being an innovative company, Radish does not just make its consumers into customers, but also makes its authors into customers. Because as you were mentioning with Spotify, well, it kind of in Spotify, it's inexplicit what's going on here, like it's kind of buried, but Radish makes it explicit. To go on our front page, what you have to do is you have to pay us money, mm-hmm. and then we'll put you on the front page. And so authors, in order to kind of become successful in these places, and obviously the very top people will become successful, but most authors are not just paying to play, you know, but lots of them are losing money.
Mm-hmm. Mm. I mean, it's the same thing with musicians. I mean, anything creative, you know, there's artists that do, you know, paintings that get their stuff taken and made into shirts on like t-shirt.com or even Walmart and Target. You know, the same thing happens as well.
Well, this has also become a thing with the new kind of AI art thing, because people are saying like you're saying these are kind of things drawn by the AI, but all you're doing is you're kind of getting all of our pieces of work and kind of like jamming and mixing them together and pushing something out, and you're claiming that's kind of your original art. Well, there's obviously no creativity from the machine. You're just exploiting our production and giving us nothing.
Which I guess too is like it's. I have a question on what do you think any potential pushback or like, because at this point, yeah, if I play a song, right? It's Friday. I'm about to get off stream. I hit Nuck If You Buck, so people are ready to fucking go on the weekend. And for that replay of that stream, you know, it's going to be blanked out. You're not mm-hmm. allowed to get Nuck If You Buck right now. Right? Is there any potential for this type of automated, you know, just mass search out and like kind of destroy type of thing? Because that's things like these people do own like the quote unquote characters. People can write and like put whatever out, you know,
about Harry Potter or whatever. It happens to this show all the time. Facebook just released a hold they had on this show from an episode that Pascal and I did last year, where they said music that I had literally played live instruments in wasn't mine. The intro song to this show, Facebook said that wasn't mine.
Well, yeah, I think something which is kind of you'd hope for is that at some point we would have kind of alternative platforms which would be non-commercial, that you'd have, you know, in terms of fan fiction, there's fanfiction.net, which is kind of a commercial website with advertising and so on, which tries to make a profit. But that has become much less popular now than Archive of Our Own, which is a non-commercial advocacy group, where it's all free, kind of you support it with donations or whatever, but it's completely non-commercial. And then this has led to it being, because fanfiction.net is very censorious because they're very scared of losing their advertising, while Archive Our Own is very non-censorious because they're an advocacy group. And so you'd hope one day that they kind of would be, you know, Spotify or YouTube, which is non-commercial, you know, non-profit making. But the problem with that is obviously for YouTube, the bandwidth is just completely unaffordable for anyone that isn't Google, you know? Yep. And for something like Spotify, you have to have all these kind of licensing rights from all these companies. And it's this incredibly complex legal maze, which again, you can only navigate if you're a massive company.
I mean, the fan fiction world is actually very interesting. I mean, I think we underestimate its influence on popular culture and, you know, how even in this world of the Marvelification or superheroification of movies, how fan fiction does influence what movies actually come out, what licenses Marvel wants to go out and buy again, because remember, they sold off everything in the 90s. Trying to stay afloat. And real quick, I do want to ask your guys' opinion if you've even been following this. So since we are talking about bullshit pop culture, apparently Batgirl is not coming out. They paid tens of millions of dollars to make the movie. It's done. It's in the can. And you can release a crap movie in different ways. It's in the can. In an era where superhero movies are paramount.
They released Morbius twice.
Twice. And I still haven't watched it. It's in my queue. I'm afraid to watch it.
It's insane.
I'm afraid to watch it. I mean, if you guys don't want to watch Morbius, there's a three-story arc on the 90s Spider-Man cartoon where Morbius and Blade are introduced in the 90s. Watch that.
The Batgirl thing seems bizarre, right? Like, why are they not
didn't. So, I've been watching bigger YouTube channels for no good reason. And to see why. Like, why does someone watch this shit? And so, there's this person, 800,000 views on their reason why Batgirl didn't come out. And their long story short rationale was that DC and Disney have become too woke by changing characters' races. Now, where I felt this person missed the ball, and they were lying and said, they're like, I'm from Scotland, and I'm back in. I was like, you're not from Scotland. You sound like you're from, like, New York, trying to make a Scottish accent. But anyway, the guy was saying that DC was too woke, and they changed the color of Barbara Gordon, a.k.a. Catwoman. And then they were trying to make a alternative universe Catwoman. I'm sorry, Batgirl, where Michael Keaton's Batman would come back. So Michael Keaton is in this new Batgirl movie, the original 89 Batman. Now, if you watched the 1960s Batman, as people my age did, and Pascal probably watched it in syndication as well, you would know probably the most popular Batgirl was the extremely colored Eartha Kitt.
The Catwoman.
She was Catwoman. She was Catwoman. So was it Julie Newmar was Batgirl?
Julie Newmar was the first Catwoman.
She was the first Catwoman. Who was Batgirl?
Batgirl was a random actress. I forgot her name.
I love the fact that Pascal knows that, and he was so cool. Like, you can't even get that by him and trick him. And he was like, no.
I think an important factor here is Ezra Miller.
Ezra Miller was meant to be a cancer to the production, which I'm like, well, I don't give a shit. But because why?
Batgirl was meant to be introduced in the new Flash movie. And Ezra Miller's Flash was also playing a prominent role in the Michael Keaton Batman movie. And that's all fucked up to no end, and that's not going anywhere. So I think that kind of Batgirl didn't get an introduction, so I think that's probably another reason, because of Ezra Miller. I don't even know what's happening with Flash, but yeah, that's not going anywhere fast.
But why do you think Batgirl got canned?
I don't know.
There are people who are really not a fan of seeing black men and women, particularly black women, play these kind of reinvigorated roles in these places that are totally fictional. For example, you know, you guys are way more into pop culture than I am, particularly you, Jason. When I saw the reaction to the new woman who was playing a Sith Lord, the black woman,
yeah,
and people lost their minds.
Yeah.
Oh, this is too much. I can't take this anymore. This is incredible. I don't understand. I was like, you realize there's no such thing as a Sith, right?
You know what? Like, read the comments when George Lucas was married to a black woman. Yeah, that was bad when he married that black woman. But there are character changes that people don't complain about that are white to black. Nick Fury in the Marvel Universe is a white man. And
Samuel Jackson.
David Hasselhoff played Nick Fury in a Nick Fury movie that ended up going straight to cable or video in the 90s.
I mean, it's probably just because the transition happened before our really intense culture war that we have now.
Well, no, and he was a character that wasn't a huge... You know, it wasn't that big of a deal.
Well, and that may be because part of it, yeah, right? Because, like, Nick Fury in the mines, and I don't know the comic books, right? But like, as far as like watching normal fucking TV and not being a dweeb, Nick Fury's in the background, right? He can switch. You know, they don't give a fuck about Nick Fury. They give a fuck about the people, the, you know, who are the stars. Those people have to stay the same. You know, I mean, because I saw shit about the live action Little Mermaid.
Oh, she was black, right?
Yeah, it's like, what the fuck is wrong with
people? Because they're worried about the great replacement theory, man.
Ariel's black now. Yeah,
like,
Damn,
let me ask you guys a question, and a serious question. And Jean used to joke about this all the time because Jean would watch Supergirl, and Jean would talk about how woke Supergirl was, and the people that wrote Supergirl made another show on Netflix about football that lived in this weird universe of, you know, underclass ideology that to me was hilarious, but it was super woke. Do you think there is something about the quote unquote wokeness of trying to change the race? Because I asked this question, you know what, Tucson, if you could put the link up, if you can find it, Dan Larson and I had this conversation on the first time I ever had Dan on the show when it was still an audio only podcast. And Dan talked about his first time being introduced to a racial swap of characters, and it was the Daredevil live action movie in the 2000s in the aughts with Ben Affleck and Michael Clark Duncan as Kingpin.
Right.
And Dan Larson's thing was, well, what does he bring to the character? Is the character totally changing? And how does now his race change the backstory that I know of with Kingpin? Does it make it cooler? Does it make it more interesting? And, you know, kind of like you, Pascal, like, and what does it really matter?
I mean, an interesting critique I've seen recently is, this is, for instance, in kind of like British period dramas, they've, from kind of set in the 18th and 19th century in the UK, they've started to introduce kind of like racially blind casting.
Oh, yes.
Kind of racially mixed casting.
The Hamilton model.
But this obviously completely obscures and disappears kind of the actual racialized system of the British Empire, which it holds more than that intent, but like...
Like, for example, there's a new film calling, what's it called, Mr. Malcolm? About a black guy who was in Britain during the 19th century, might be even 18th century, and he's going on like a dating spree trying to find women of color to like hook up with. And he's kind of like dandying about, and of course we know that Britain ended slavery in the 1730s and they never had plantation slavery on the island. But at the same time, there was a certain kind of racial classification system that existed that would have made the capacity of a person with African features having somewhat of a limitation in his ability to just be bandied about in society. And I'm not a big fan of these shows. There's another one that's on Netflix. I forgot, it's rooted in this like 19th or 18th century British royal period, and it has black characters and whatnot. And my whole thing is, it's like, why are black people made to seem desperate to be royalty all the time? Why is this a set assumption that there's this desperate need for black people to be what, in terms of the hierarchy of exploitation, in terms of society, is the worst, which is a fucking monarch.
Which, and the thing is, like, I guess too, is like, to your point, you could make stories about black kingdoms, you know, or black kings and queens and shit like that.
Look,
make
when a we fucking, saw Shaka Zulu back in
the
day.
But the thing is too, is like, when they make movies about Egypt, who do they cast? And like, come on.
Stefan.
The funny thing about making Cleopatra black or whatever is they were from an intensely incestuous family. Really, she should be white, but like fucked up looking.
That's true. And she was.
I mean, my whole thing is, I'm not saying that you should not have empire. Of course there were black empires. There were black civilizations. There were black empires in the Caribbean. I get that. I understand that. What I'm saying is that it just makes it seem like I have a problem with this assumption that black people are desperate for some kind of remedy to their problems that needs to be seen through them being some kind of monarchical royal figure because their self-esteem is so broken and crushed. That whole vindicationist nonsense really bothers me, man.
That was the end of my last video essay. Same, right? With all these black people crying in front of the late Chadwick Boseman. Like, oh my son got to grow up with Obama and now you. He was like, I'm an actor. I'm sorry. This ain't real.
I'm sorry. I'm
not actually a king.
I'm not the king of shit.
But yeah, but then as Pascal says, if he was a king, that would be bad.
Which is weird because I don't see all these black people going, man, Idi Amin, what a great guy. Like, I don't
I'm sure you can find on kind of Afrocentrist Twitter some people that are ADM means that.
You know, one of the things I was telling Torre this one time. One of the things that I've liked about the British depiction of black characters is how they've made them profoundly human without having to make their blackness distinct and still made them interesting characters. And a perfect example of that in the show is Luther. I loved that show with Idris Elba, where he played a kind of anti-hero cop who had major flaws, was not like this like wonderful, excellent, perfect black excellence kind of figure, but was interesting as hell. And the thing that was done, it was that his race was not the driving narrative of the story, but it was actually his humanity. People didn't
if we kind of try to make that narrative in the U.S., you'd be accused basically.
No, it wouldn't work.
Yeah, they'd say you would erase his blackness if you didn't have the police stop him one time.
No, it's really.
Their shows are written differently out there.
We say again, Toussaint?
Shows are written differently out there. I think the production of TV shows, of serials in the U.S. is just super dominated by capitalism and capitalism's lack of imagination.
Well, I think, so yeah, like, I mean... How racialized The Wire was.
Wire is about neoliberalism in the inner city, right? And how it affects the inner city and how you get this...
underclass ideology in The Wire, man.
Yeah, but still, isn't that what it's about? That's literally what it's about, though.
Yeah, because I mean, like, The Wire is like a more like a long form like mockumentary or document, you know, like a kind of like, you know, quasi documentary on like the what was going on in Baltimore and like policing and shit like that and government corruption, you know, like there is a fucking Barksdale family in Baltimore that was like drug running and like some of these Italian fucking. You know, politicians' names are just tweaked off a little bit. you know, so, and, but like, that seems like there are racial tensions that play into, you know, that narrative or like history and then like the narrative that they use in the fucking show. But I mean, like, I guess to the point though, is like, is this superficially injected, right? Or, you know, like, are you telling a story that is a reflection of, you know, racist sentiments in the United States, or are you saying, hey, you know, there was some pretty big protests, now we need to have, you know, now we're teenage drama, black kid in the streets, always every day it's a different cop harassing him or some shit like that, you know, which would just be a fake in, you know, injection of this type of thing.
Ishmael Reed hated The Wire.
Did he really?
Yeah, he did. He thought it was racist trash.
Well, you know, Ishmael Reed is also the same person that said lock up a 13-year-old.
Lying niggas up. Well, exactly. So, well, Ishmael Reed is also the same guy who said, I was not part of any movements in the 60s. I don't trust movements.
Ishmael Reed also wrote a response to Hamilton.
That's true. Ishmael Reed also trashed Stanley Crouch when he died.
I almost said Stanley Clark.
That's the really crazy stuff. Like in the UK.
I would really now, Jason. You know, I know he's your Oakland homeboy, but I like Ishmael Reed. I'm not gonna lie.
I love that. Look, if you guys want to know who Ishmael Reed is and you don't know, there's a video of Huey Newton, Ishmael Reed, and I forget the last guy. And they're talking about black men in the 80s. And this is right before Huey Newton actually gets murdered. So it's a pretty good interview. And it was done in the Bay Area on a show called People Are Talking. So if you Google, look up on YouTube, People Are Talking, Ishmael Reed, Huey Newton, that whole show will come up. It's about 35 minutes. If you want to get a good example of who Ishmael Reed is.
Listen, there's something about post-civil rights kind of black arts movement era black writers that come of age in the 80s during the Reagan. Because I guess I was growing up and those were the guys that were the only ones who were getting publication space and seeing them, and Greg Tate was kind of one of them. Mm-hmm. I have a certain kind of affection for them. But you know, in an age where everyone nowadays has a byline because of the internet, you know, it's easy to lose the respect for the guys who were doing it when there was no other voices around. But Ishmael Reed and Stanley Crouch, those guys put out some interesting commentary. Controversial as hell, pissed off a lot of different types of black people. But interesting voices, man.
Toussaint put a link up to that show. It's pretty funny. I shouldn't say funny. It's just interesting to hear.
Oh, it's interesting. It's again makes me think of one of our favorite subject matters on this show is the representation of race in the 50-plus year counter-revolution, both at an intellectual level and both at a popular cultural level.
The last guy in the interview is Jawanza Kunjufu.
Jawanza Kunjufu, the conspiracy to destroy black men, black boys.
Yes. Yes. He talks about that in the show.
Yes. So black male crisis theory.
Because there's white teachers in the crowd. They're like, I have all these colored students in my class and these niggers won't sit still. I don't know what is it about these kids? They won't sit still. They're breaking shit everywhere. What?
Can't just fail them? What's up?
What do I need to do? What do I need to do?
In this new Jim Crow book, which I don't know, I'm asking this because I don't know if it's actually true, but they were saying that like in the early 2000s, civil rights groups basically just didn't talk about the issue of imprisonment. Like they would do stuff about trying to stop executions, but that was basically it. And then they just didn't really talk about there being like millions of
black people. There wasn't a crisis to the level that she was talking about? Of mass incarceration?
No, as in the mass incarceration was there were all these people in prison, but civil rights actors weren't really talking about it.
Like, you talking about in the 60s, 70s, or 80s?
The 2000s.
I would push back against that. I think
that's when we start to see the beginning of the anti-carceral state. It starts from the early aughts.
Yeah. That's where she got that from walking around in Oakland. And she saw the whole new Jim Crow framing. So I've been hearing that for some time. That's around, I mean, the 90s is when we start getting the whole 1 in 4 black men under the age of 18 are dead.
That goes back to the 80s, bro.
So
versus college.
It's just the solutions are different, right? We're not talking about mass incarceration. I think we're talking more so about, well, these kids are dying or going to prison, so we need to put them all in college. We're not saying teach them how to code, but it's all, get them all in college.
The educational solutions.
Yeah, they're going to get educated, and that'll get them out of this trap, this prison trap.
Question, though. Going back to like what Stefan was talking about earlier, and this is kind of going to just shit writing. like the fucking, collectivation, basically these monopolies now that like own all of the stories and shit like that. And then like Netflix now has this like The Gray Man, which.
What is that about?
It's an action movie with a crisis of conscience. Okay. Cause it's three action movies in one.
Okay.
Redeemed Badass.
You got me there. Anti-hero?
yeah, slightly still like that's these. It's 3-1 still like. Okay, so you've got redeemed badass antihero, you've got super spy, and you've got save the little girl, right?
Oh, is she white?
Are these three different guys or one guy?
It's all the same guy. It's the gray man.
But is the little girl white?
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah.
Adorable? Is she adorable?
Well, in the beginning, so it starts out like how they meet. You know, he's basically like got to kill other spies that are trying to take her out because of who her uncle. Either way, right? So it's three action movies blended into one.
Mm-hmm.
And it's absurd, right? I thought it was like the best. It's like the best mockery of a 1980s action movie, but like super well produced.
It's a movie or a series?
It's a movie that they are making into a series. They are trying to create. They are creating their own Marvel Universe type thing from this Gray Man movie.
Is it well done? Are you telling us we should watch it? Is this telling us we should watch it?
No. Jason, you should watch it.
What? Hey, I can't watch pop culture?
Pascal, I'm trying to respect you, right? So Jason will get engaged in media that is a waste of your time. All right? Can we agree on that?
I was reading Nacho shit last night, watching like the worst movies. I got all of that Hard Ticket to Hawaii, like shit like that.
Yeah.
The Bobby DeBarge story.
It's
the Bobby DeBarge story is my new favorite. I'm so mad, you people, all you black people that watch this show that act like you're so pro-black and get mad as, why you guys all down on Afro-pessimism, Jay? Blah, 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 blah. Not one of you Negroes told me that there was a Bobby DeBarge documentary with
people
with bad
ways. Is it Bobby DeBarge
though? Black. Thank you! Y'all don't love us! Y'all black don't hot. Love us!
What channel is it on?
I found it on Vimeo.
I found it on YouTube.
It's on YouTube.
But I had to find it on YouTube. Didn't nobody tell me? Y'all don't love us?
Well, there is so a
pro-black. I'm going to watch more black shows because y'all ain't black enough. Well, you know what? I could have got blacker had I known the Bobby DeBarge documentary was on.
They're wigs.
This is not to be confused with the DeBarge on Unsung, right?
No, this is a whole, like a movie. Like a movie with light-skinned people.
Oh, so I think this is a biopic.
Filipinos. Yes.
This is a biopic.
Yes.
This is a Bobby DeBarge biopic.
You have to see this beige dude running around.
What? They made a Bobby DeBarge biopic before they made an El DeBarge biopic?
Because Bobby died. El DeBarge is still singing and smoking crack.
Stefan is like, I don't know who any of these Negroes are. Okay.
Stefan, if you want to know who DeBarge is.
Let's do drug trafficking charges in 1988.
Yeah. You know what I didn't know? I didn't know Chico DeBarge went down with him.
Oh, that's how he ended up in prison?
That's how Chico ended up in prison.
That makes, wow.
Them DeBarges was light. That's like, and throughout the movie, Bobby is like hella hood and shit. And then the other brother's like, hey, don't let that light skin shit fool you. My brother Bobby is a badass.
Don't tell me that's a line in the movie. Don't tell me that's a line.
I'm not making it up at all.
I like when light-skinned people get like that. It's cool.
Bobby DeBarge is just acting like a damn fool. This kid's got this wig on, and he's like, you niggas can't tell me what to do. I'm Bobby DeBarge. Who the fuck you think the bitches come to see? They come to see me, nigga. And then he's
like, David Ruffin. Okay, okay.
And this little kid is just, I was like, oh. Then he goes to prison, and these dudes are fucking with these buff-ass black dudes. But like, imagine like a bunch of Marcuses come up to you in prison.
Isn't that every Bobby prison DeBarge scene, though?
Each one with their own cat.
And fucking with Bobby DeBarge. And he goes, and they're like, and they're singing, ooh, and I like it. That's El DeBarge. He's like, that's not me. That's my brother. And they're like, so what? All the same nigga to me. And then they punch Bobby DeBarge in the fucking face.
Chico was mad young. He went down for that.
Yeah.
M. Toussaint was all into this one, huh? M. Toussaint.
Because it was, dude, as bad as it was. And you know who the mom was? The mom was the mom in Boys in the Hood.
Oh, man. What's the name of this, man? I'm going on YouTube. What's
it's called the Bobby the Barge story, and you motherfuckers didn't tell me about it. That's why I'm mad at the internet.
The wigs are ridiculous.
Listen, I recently watched a video on YouTube which is called Black Metal. Fascism and Black Metal and How to Spot It, which I found interesting in kind of talking about how, like, methods you can use, like which symbols that aren't the obvious ones indicate fascism, what kind of lyrical content, and how to kind of like find it through connections to other band members, kind of public statements, like basically like by asking people like what they think of Burzum, you can basically tell if they're fascist or not. Like, if like Burzum inspires everyone, but if they're like, you know, I'm really inspired by Burzum, but obviously they're Nazis and blah, 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 and Bard's a fucking the worst guy in the world. If they do that, they're probably not fascist. If they just say Burzum was a big influence and move on, then they probably are fascist or fascist and sympathetic. But what I found interesting about this video was kind of the attitude that the person took in it, which is basically assuming that any leftist person should definitely not want to listen to any fascist black metal. And that if they did so, they would be kind of like tainted, basically. That there was inherently kind of a problem, not just like, it's not just a problem of being unaware, but that as soon as you know that someone is a fascist, mm-hmm. you wouldn't want to listen to their media, you wouldn't want to engage with it because it has kind of this dirty effect. And I found it this very, in like a clear example of this strange attitude that I see on some parts of the left as regards to media, where people are very reluctant to consume kind of fascist media. Of course, the funny thing is, all media more or less is capitalist media, but mm-hmm. leftists and communists and socialists seem to be fine consuming that, you know?
I do find it interesting when you get into the fascist discussion when it comes to black metal, because I have been, as you know, kind of close to those worlds because of the music that I've done. And then especially when you start getting into the more obscure stuff, which we got thrown into in my last band with my ex. I find it interesting the excuses people give on why they listen to certain, like Death in June. They think Death in June is totally cool to listen to.
I mean, I don't know. Maybe you have a different opinion, but I don't make excuses. I just sit in my room and listen to.
If you like, look, you're gonna like what you like. But again, now I get to look at you a certain way and be like, well, maybe that guy's idea is.
That's the thing though, is that like, isn't that also like a fair thing, right? Because like, this thing's like, I don't listen to a whole lot of R. Kelly anymore. You know?
Oh yeah, like I
and it's not because Remix to Ignition. Yeah.
And some things do put me off, right?
Yeah.
But I think the strange attitude in this video was assuming that would be the case for everyone.
You know, and I've told this story, I don't know if I've ever told it on the main show, but we played a show in Richmond, Virginia in 2019. I will never forget this. And we had a good mosh pit going. And it was a bunch of black kids that came to this show. We were on tour we're opening for a bigger band and called Divide and Dissolve. And we surprisingly brought a lot of people of color out. And the crowd was this weird mix of people that knew what a mosh pit was and people that didn't.
Yeah, yeah.
So when we did our last song, I stopped and I was like, okay. Some people don't know what a mosh pit is. For those of you that don't, stand back. Actually, for everybody, let's just jump. Let's just jump because this is going to get bad. So we have this thing, if you've ever seen the live video of Rat Food, where I talk a little bit and then this kind of like bouncy thing, right? So everybody's like jumping and people are like, I've never ran around in a circle and had fun. And people are losing their shit. And we're done. And this white dude, there's one or two white dudes in the crowd. Whole crowd of black. Again, heavy music, black people. This is weird shit for me. And this black girl comes. socks the white dude. White dude's out in front of me. It's like, oh, shit. What happened? I didn't see him touch her in the pit. I don't know. Security comes up and he goes, because he's in this big white dude. He's like, what? And the white dude gets up. He's like, what did I do? He didn't know what he did. And security looks at the black people. He looks at the white dude. He goes, hey, man, I just got to take you out. I don't know what you did. I got to take you out. Like, I'm just going to play the numbers here. I'm going to take you outside. And the white dude's just like, what did I do? And the black girl's like, you know what you did. You know what you did. So I go up to her and I was like, excuse me. What did he do? She goes, don't talk to me. And I was like, oh, fuck you, Richard. You know what? You can eat. Hey, bring the white. So she calms down and she comes, she apologizes. She's like, I was just so worked up. It's like, okay, well, what happened? And the white boy had a burzum patch on his jacket. And she hit him and then she ripped the patch off. I didn't see that. Like that's like she and she wasn't a very that little skinny girl packed a hell of a punch. She floored him, took his patch off, and she was like, these white motherfuckers know what they do. They wear these patches when we're around. And Richmond, Virginia is very different than where I grew up in the West Coast because there's a pretty big black scene in the hardcore scene there. There's a lot of bad brains are from that area, a little further north. But there's just black people in the heavy music out there. And this kid was he liked burzum. And so I'm talking to all of them outside and the security guard who's extremely confused. And we're having this good conversation. And the white kid ends up hitting me up personally on social or one of the ways to hit us up. And he goes, I'm so sorry that happened at your show. I would love for you to come back. I thought you guys were awesome. It was one of the best shows. And I was like, well, what's with the patch, man?
Yeah.
And he was like, oh, I think that guy's just crazy. I was like, yeah. Yeah, he is. But, you know, you don't think that that's going to make people feel any kind of way? He goes, well, I don't believe in the shit he says.
Yeah.
I just dig, you know, his early stuff and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, look, that's what you did.
Yeah, like,
what
it's obvious like what wearing that patch signals to people. Because it's a way to subtly, without wearing a swastika, to wear something of a black metal band to indicate you're fascist. And often, like, it's quite strange. Like, so I was listening to this video, the one I mentioned, and they mentioned that one band, Batushka, what I assumed were kind of fascist inclined, because they do like kind of they sing, they do like religious black metal, and they sing it in old church Slavonic, this dead liturgical language in Eastern Europe. But and for obvious reasons, kind of, and with imagery and so on, I assumed they were kind of fascist or fascist inclined or whatever. But they said in this video that no, actually, Batushka probably almost certainly aren't fascist because through this thing of band member tracking. And one of their main members is also in an anti-fascist crust punk band. And so clearly they're not fascist. But if you still look at Batushka's t-shirts, they look fascist as hell. So regardless of the fact, if Batushka are fascist and not fascist, I'm still not going to wear one of their t-shirts because they look really fascist. And even if I think that looks cool, I don't want to... You know, I don't want to signal to fascists that there's another fascist, and I don't want to signal to anti-fascists that I'm a fascist. So the kind of even, I think, this kid wearing a burzum patch is really stupid for obvious reasons.
Yeah. And it's also funny that you talk about that because I remember we were having this discussion with years ago with Boots Riley at the studio, and we were bitching about why we weren't getting like enough fucking look and da da da. And he's like, well, your imagery doesn't match the picture, or the picture doesn't match the sound of the band. You guys sound industrial, but this is a really arty looking photo, and they know there's a woman in the group, so they're not going to think you guys are like this heavy industrial experimental group. So, you know, maybe your imagery should reflect the way you sound. So when these guys are black metal bands, you adopt this image, this iconography that now is so synonymous with Nazism. For me personally, as a person that, you know, I'm a passive listener to new shit at this point. If I see the writing I can't read, I just assume you're a racist.
Is black metal innately fascistic?
Sure.
Like, the very early black metal wasn't fascist, but then kind of the main first wave of black metal was started by Burzum. Well, kind of they predominated in it, and the kind of the leader Burzum was a neo-Nazi who went to prison for murder. But of course, you know.
Oh my God.
Bob only ever killed one white guy, so you know.
Yeah, he killed his bandmate. He killed his bandmate because he could, and you only get 21 years. In that country for killing
someone. Yeah, so now he's out in France and he's got like 6 kids with an autistic French woman.
And he hates Jews. Oh, he hates Jews.
Really?
Oh, he hates colors too.
He's been quit until lately, but I think he's been banned again.
Yeah. There's a documentary about him. I mean, look, whenever you do something extreme, people think that means you're good. A bunch of people that couldn't play their instruments very well burnt some churches, and one guy killed a guy, and that's like the legacy of that genre. If that's the legacy of your genre, you are the equivalent of 50 Cent. I got shot 8 times. Can you rap? You got shot 8 times. How's the album? Man, he got shot 8 times. Don't care.
Well, as someone who likes 50 Cent and Vogue.
He got shot 9 times, and his rap was good in the beginning, then got progressively worse. How about that?
You think he actually got shot 9 times? Because he only has 3 injuries.
Well, he got shot with a .22. He didn't get shot with a...
Oh, did he?
Yeah.
He got peppered.
Yeah, I mean, hell yeah. It's like...
Don't say that. Listen, man, we don't want 50 mad at our show, man.
He could be mad at our show as much as he wants to be. I'll take the views. Hey, 50.
You don't want to go his views. You know, he is still messing with y'all rules.
Yeah. What's the worst that could happen if 50 Cent got mad at me?
He's going to buy all the tickets to your show and then leave the seats empty.
Dope. I can actually make money. Thanks, yeah, 50.
That sounds like an early night off. Thank
yeah,
you.
That's what it sounds like to me. The bartender, the bar staff is about to get a great show.
Yeah, exactly.
People got mad because I was trolling Kim Kardashian because she's single now.
Man, don't do that.
Why?
Well, you're trying to become the next thing.
Well, you mean the next thing with the Kardashian? Yeah, that's cool. Yeah.
He has a podcast.
Okay. They're into white guys.
I'm podcast
now.
And an apartment. I can offer so much.
They're into white guys now.
No, but you have to find like an Asian guy.
No, unless she gets with Andrew Yang, which would be the greatest thing for left media since the Trump years, if Kim Kardashian got with Andrew Yang.
Yeah. I'd stop.
Oh, he's married, actually.
Yeah. Yes.
To a lady that he kisses with his mask on.
A lady that he does what with his mask on?
He kisses. He's one of those politicians in those commercials where they're kissing with the mask on.
Huh.
It's not as crazy as it sounds.
I thought she was with that strange looking dude from SNL. Yeah, they broke up and Business Insider fucking had a whole headline story about Kim Kardashian breaking up with Pete. What's his name? Pete Wentz? Pete Davidson.
Pete Davidson.
That is him, yeah.
It's his another band.
Fallout Boy?
Yeah.
Oh, God, I heard so many weird stories about them that I will not tell on here.
Isn't he black, Pete Wentz? He's related to like some famous.
Oh, I didn't get to say this at the time, but I went on Alex Jones's website to look at his appetite to coffee. And there's two things. One, he sells it so much that you can't currently buy it from him. You have to join a waiting list.
Whoa!
You want to buy his Zapata coffee. And the second thing is quite funny. They advertise that like it's no GMO and all this kind of stuff and no artificial fertilizer or whatever. it's just funny because it's purely to do with kind of the low level of economic development in Chiapas. Like, I'm sure if they could GMO them and could fucking put all these pesticides and shit on them, they would. They just don't do them because they can't afford it.
Yeah.
So Alex Jones is literally supporting the Zapatistas with his coffee.
Yep.
I can smell the sulfur. I have friends that have been around Obama and Hillary. They smell like sulfur. Driving to work.
I think he has talked about them on the show a bit.
I don't know if y'all have seen any of the clips because of his trial, you know, or the court, you know, was going.
I just read that he made a text message that the day of the Sandy Hook thing, he made $800,000.
Yeah. Well, when it was actually insane because he was still doing shows. He would live stream, talk about, you know, what's going on. Talk shit about the judge. There was like he was like showing memes about the judge on fire, and then in the fucking thing, you know, in questioning, they're like, "Alex, did you threaten the judge?" Showing pictures of her on fire. No, and then they're like showing him talking about it, like literally the day before. The whole thing like just didn't make any sense because he just like blatantly lies about everything that's verifiable.
Alex Jones. Driving to Coachella one year, this dude thought it was funny to listen to Alex Jones on Joe Rogan. So we had to listen to Alex Jones, and I thought it was the funniest shit ever.
It'd be funny if he wasn't like a fucking psychopath that like actually hurt people.
Oh, have you ever heard him talk about Hillary Clinton and Obama smelling like sulfur?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean,
they're like Nosferatu. They smell like sulfur.
You can smell the sulfur. He was so.
I don't know if Doc Chorizo is still in the chat, but there's like someone who takes Alex Jones. There's a bunch of YouTube videos. They take Alex Jones on his crazy rants and they put him in like a Warhammer like figurine. So it's just him like, and I'm gonna tell you, the globalists, we're going down. This is a universal problem that we're going to go on. Like, you just, it's pretty funny.
When he does the I will eat your ass thing.
Oh, I will eat your leftist ass like corn on the cob.
Marcus does the good Alex Jones.
The Marine Corps voice. The Marine Corps voice transfers over.
Okay, look, we've been going on too long. This is definitely what the champagne room is like. Thank you guys for joining us. Tuesday we're gonna have
Can you play the Alex Jones clip? It's like 30 seconds.
Oh my god, is this what I think it is? Just 30 seconds, we should be able to get away with it.
It's in trouble.
Oh, here we go.
Hold on, I'm trying to open it. Hold on.
It's fine because it's Hassan reacting to it, so it's like two layers of reaction, so we should be fine.
Hold on.
Discourse about the discourse.
Alex Jones
turning the content.
I will eat your leftist ass.
Marcus got the Alex Jones down.
Marcus has a very good Alex Jones. Marcus, props to you for doing an impression.
This is a new. It'll be the new fucking part of the show.
I watched that Hassan interview with that or debate with that guy. What's his name? The guy that looks kind of black. That
Taint?
Christian Walker?
Yeah, that guy.
Andrew Taint?
Yeah. That was interesting. Because I was like, I don't get this guy at all.
Base.
This is from, Chiapas, Mexico, the communist.
Oh my god, he literally buys coffee from the fucking libertarian socialist EZLN.
Some of the best coffee in the world that's wild harvested, above organic, in the volcanic soil, better than Guatemalan coffee. And yeah, we buy it from the little farmers that the media calls communists, but really they're just a commune. And whatever. The point is that it's good coffee, and we've got it, and the farmers don't let the Mexican government take over. So I actually buy this from the Mexican rebels, and I've been buying it for, 14 years. And the price.
Oh my god! This is insane. Bro, they are straight the fuck up. Like, one of the most functional organizations that still have libertarian socialist values. Like, They are literally a fucking... Yeah, he says they're not communists, they're just a commune. Yeah, what do you think that is, dumbass?
I just never run up. The same stuff sold at Whole Foods under another name for about 50% more per pound, and I just think it's some of the best coffee you're going to find anywhere. It's Wake Up America, Patriot Blend from the Chiapas Rebel.
Dude, that's insane.
He sells coffee.
Oh my God, Alex Jones is offering more material support to a robust, active communist movement
like the big
than like 90% of leftists and all of the fucking Western world liberals.
Yep, Alex Jones is America's greatest communist.
Anyway, yeah. I don't watch much Hassan Piker, and I can tell why now. Oh my God, he's good.
Well, you know, Twitch is made for people that need 8 things going at once. I'm playing a video game. I'm on my phone. There's TV in the background.
And there's a pretty boy in the corner.
Yeah.
Face in the chat.
Yes, that's why I have a Winston cam and a little spinning cube. Right? You gotta keep fucking. You gotta.
I can't. Like nothing on Twitch I take seriously because it's like every 5 minutes there's like they have those sound effects. It's like I'm like that dude.
See, there's some channels. How can
anyone take you seriously?
There's channels that allow the chat can initiate the sounds and shit like that, and yeah, and so like at times it can just be, yeah, I mean, which like that's the thing too, it's like entertainment, right? If it's entertaining you, enjoy yourself.
It's entertainment for a new generation of people that need multiple things going on all at once.
Yeah. Well, you talk about this shit all the time, right? Access, right? You talk about fucking on-demand shit, right? Everything right now, right now, right now. You know, eventually it's multiple things at once, you know, and yeah, you know, not every stream is like that, you know.
Dear Tucson.
No.
She said that's what she said.
Terrible.
Oh my God. Okay, guys. It's gone too long. Stefan's got to go eat that chocolate sausage. What do they call it out there?
Who's that?
What?
What?
Oh, that's a blood sausage.
Blood sausage, yeah, but it's black.
Yeah.
Boudin.
Chocolate.
He's like, my mom gave me that.
Which, and someone mentioned in the chat, Pascal, you should be like, you would, I think you would have a very, very good conversation with Hassan, because like, that's the thing too, is like, he does that, but like, he's actually able to like.
Yes, you know, totally.
He did a good job with that, rapist pimp guy.
I mean, which like, that's the thing though. I mean, we're about to fucking dip, you know, but like.
Racist pimps.
That, yeah, the racist pimp shit.
Rapist.
He got more rapist pimp. Yeah, he got more like fucking. Even though Hassan was like fucking talking about how his whole thing was a grift, it's a like scam. Don't fucking. He got more scams. You know.
Yeah.
Like he still like.
I'm sorry. I mean, that's your boy. I mean, I give him a try. I mean, listen, Marcus ain't gonna push somebody on me that he ain't.
I told you, me and Ben met him. About grift, I love when people call like Breonna Joy Gray a grift or somebody like that, and then that guy, that Tate guy, is literally making like 6 figures a month.
Yeah,
like, you know, if you think anyone here is a grifter, I got bad news for you, homie.
Well, Marcus got the flat, isn't it him? Oh no, that was Cuba.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I've got a whole fake.
A leftist grifter is only economical if you have like no other skills.
Yeah, well, because I've got a whole my grift. I've got a whole fake right wing persona, right, about the black veteran that wants to defend this nation against communists. That's the grift, okay?
Yeah.
I'm fucking spitting into little pill capsules and selling tea dick pills for people for $50 a pop. That's the grift, okay? This
if
shit.
Marcus grifting, he'd be one of those black veterans that go on Demolition Ranch and get like 10 million videos.
Yeah, no shit.
Shooting a gun.
Today we're testing out the new Glock 49.
The Cal 50.
I see that shit all the time. Like, this guy's a grifter. This guy's a grifter. It's like, man, that motherfucker works at oil changers, man. Leave that motherfucker alone. That motherfucker is a cook at Chili's. Leave his ass alone. He is trying to make a living. Because real grifters get documentaries made about them.
They get paid.
True.
Theranos? Who's this Anna Delvey?
Yeah.
I found that story so fascinating. There's nothing about her that was interesting. She wasn't super hot. Like, I don't know what it was about her. You could easily find out if you really have followers. There's a documentary that no one wants to watch about how to make yourself Instagram famous. Yet and still, these are the people that actually come up in the next thing. There's a whole, you know, human interest piece in the New York Times about how this person swindled some rich idiot out of a bunch of money. But, you know, Marcus is a grifter because he had Hassan on his show. Fuck out of here.
You sell merch.
Yeah, I can't take you seriously at that point. Because the people that really are conning people, it ain't on the podcast sphere. No. There's just no money
in it. It's in the mega church.
Oh, the mega churches? Oh, my God.
Ding. Hit it.
Joel Osteen?
Yeah.
You really think he gives a shit about your soul?
He didn't open the doors during, was it Katrina?
Yeah.
He didn't open the doors to his church. He's like, y'all not getting my carpet wet.
Yeah. I don't He's like, Noah didn't open the doors to the ark, did he?
God has spoken to me and he said only my mistress and the kid that I like gets to stay
the
in my
chosen church. Flock.
That's it. Thank you guys, and please enjoy some cartoons from my childhood.